There is nothing wrong with your radio. Do not attempt to change the station. We are controlling the transmission. We control the volume. We can change the tone to a fuzzy bass or focus it to a tinny treble.
We can speed things up so fast you can hardly understand what's being said.
Or we can make things so slow you don't care.
We control the content. We can make it boring.
Mystery Playhouse.
Or moronic.
90.1.
We can even make it repetitive.
Mystery Playhouse.
Or moronic.
90.1.
We can even make it repetitive. It's our show. We can do anything we want, because this is...
Mystery Playhouse. 90.1.
Good evening, and welcome once more to the Mystery Playhouse. I am the Count, your host of horror. And tonight I have a lineup that is so horrific, so frightening, so boo scary, it may scare you to death. Yes, we'll feature Orson Welles in The Hitchhiker, and we'll tell a story that is so scary you'll shiver in your boots. Ooh! Good thing it has a fiery ending, huh? Yes. But right now, a story involving one of the most artistic places in the world. The hospital. They always want to draw blood, huh?
On behalf of the American Heart Association, the NBC Theater presents...
Guild Assignment, production Magnificent Obsession, director John Stahl, star Irene Dunne.
This is the Screen Directors Guild presentation of the unforgettable Lloyd C. Douglas novel, Magnificent Obsession, starring Irene Dunne in her original role. The motion picture medium is often described as the most magnificent art form ever devised, for it is a combination of all the arts. One of the most critical of these is the new and dynamic art of the screen director, for it is he who must integrate and guide the forces which combine to make the film. Therefore, it is with pride that the NBC Theater presents one of the most celebrated exponents of the screen director's art, the president of the Screen Directors Guild, Mr. George Marshall.
Thank you very much. I'm pinch-hitting tonight for John Stahl. John, as you know, directed Magnificent Obsession. Another such wonderful films as The Keys of the Kingdom, The Foxes of Harrow, and The Walls of Jericho. Magnificent Obsession is one of John's favorite pictures because of the appealingly simple manner in which it translates basic human values into film, telling of hatred turning into love and darkness into light. And speaking for myself, I know that you will enjoy Magnificent Obsession, starring Irene Dunne in her original role as Helen Hudson.
I am very calm. The vortex, the very center of the whirlwind, is the stillest. There is tense, anxious action all around me, and I am the center of that tense activity. Yet I am calm. All about me are the thin, brittle sounds of instruments being made ready, the whispers of the nurses, the low, efficient voices of my surgeons, and the surgeon. Instruments, voices, the voice of the chief surgeon speaking to me, only faintly dimmed by the anesthetic.
How do you feel? Are you all right?
Are you all right, he asks tenderly, and I say, fine, all right. When do we start?
We've started. Be a good girl now.
I'm always a good girl, but I do wish you could hold my hand. In darkness, I await my great moment, the moment that will bring me light or leave me in lifelong darkness. But I am calm. Many things swim through my mind. The music of a small girl's voice.
And Ben was young, so neatly as she dressed, and so sweetly
a wisp of music, bittersweet. And then, the sudden nightmare of a time long before Paris. I remember Brightwood, my husband's hospital on the shore of the lake, the deep, smooth, fatal lake, the quiet lake that killed my husband. And in my mind, I see again the wild, bereft eyes of Joyce Hudson, my husband's daughter, my stepdaughter, Joyce telling me how it all happened. It all comes back. It all comes back.
Father had been in surgery all day. I suppose he shouldn't have gone in swimming, but he always did. He had a cramp. We finally brought him up from the bottom.
But where was the respirator?
The respirator was gone.
Gone?
It was over at the Merrick Boathouse. That young playboy, Bobby Merrick, nearly drowned. He was drunk and he nearly drowned. He developed pneumonia and they brought him here.
Brought him here? Well, I never want to see him or meet him. Because all my life I shall know that because of him, my husband had to die. I shall always hate Bobby Merrick. Loathe him. Hate him.
Helen, you've got to talk to Bobby Merrick.
I won't.
He won't listen to anyone. He has a fever of 103 and he refuses to stay in bed.
There's nothing I can do.
Helen, you're the head of this hospital now. You must talk to him.
Oh, what have we here? Hmm? Nice.
Mr. Merrick, you've been behaving very badly.
Shucks, honey, I can't help it if I'm the active type. I want to get out.
Well, believe me, I'd be very happy to see you go. But it's our responsibility to take proper care of you.
Now, look, you don't have to recite the Hippocratic Oath to me. I had 3 years of medical school myself. And I wasn't bad either. But I was bored, so I quit.
I'm not surprised. My husband always said that the mere possession of a medical degree didn't make a doctor. It takes humility, humanity, things that you're too selfish to understand.
Now, wait a minute. Are you going to be the next one to tie into me because I happened to be drowning at the same time this Dr. Hudson was drowning? Is it my fault that this whistle-stop hospital had only one respirator? And anyhow, did I ask for it?
A lot of people loved and honored Dr. Hudson.
Sure. And they're all wondering why I should live and he had to die, huh?
Yes.
All right, I'm not worth much, but might as well face it. He's dead and I'm alive. We're both out of luck. Hey, when do we eat?
I'll have a tray up in 10 minutes.
Oh, thank you.
Mrs. Hudson.
Mrs. Hudson?
With good luck, we may be able to discharge you in a week.
Dr. Wayne Hudson's wife?
Yes.
I didn't know.
Now you know.
I suppose you hate me.
Yes, Mr. Merrick. Yes, I hate you. In the operating room, I feel no pain as the surgeons operate. I feel the dull pressure of their instruments somewhere about my head. The fine surgical lamps blaze for them, but although I am conscious, I am in total darkness. And in that darkness, I think back to the events that are having their climax here.
Mosquito forceps.
Let me remember.
More suction, please.
We discharged Bobby Merrick from the hospital, and I did not see him again for many weeks, nor did I wish to see him ever again. What happened then comes from Randolph, the stonecutter, across from the cemetery where my husband lay buried. One night in a thunderstorm, Randolph was awakened by a pounding at his door. Who should it be but Bobby Merrick, drenched, covered with mud, and of course, very, very drunk.
A ladder.
What can I do for you, sir?
A ladder. You gotta have a ladder.
A ladder, sir?
A ladder, sir. Getting out of my car, I fell into a ditch. So now I'm in a ditch and can't get out without a ladder.
Come in. Why don't you stay here overnight, and in the morning we'll find a ladder and help you climb out of that ditch.
Hey, what are all those statues around here for?
I'm a stonecutter. I make gravestones and such.
Hey, so? Who's that one over there?
That's a bust of Dr. Wayne Hudson. You may have heard of him.
Heard of him? He's haunting me. First they save my life with Dr. Hudson's lung machine, and then they take me to Dr. Hudson's hospital. And I meet a beautiful girl. Who is she? Dr. Hudson's wife. His widow. Haunting me, that's what.
Tell you what. You get some rest and sleep it off.
Haunting me.
I'll make you breakfast in the morning, and then we'll get a ladder and look for you.
Good morning, Randolph.
Oh, come in, Mrs. Hudson. I've finished the bust, and I'm ready to mount it on your husband's tombstone any time you say.
Oh, thank you, Randolph. That's why I came down this morning. Oh.
Mrs. Hudson, Mr. Robert Merrick.
We've met.
My car stalled last night with a wet carburetor. Randolph here is good enough to put me up overnight.
Randolph, I'm ready to go to my husband's grave whenever you're ready.
Ready right now. I'll get my coat and my boots. Rather muddy this morning.
I'd like a word with you, Mrs. Hudson, when you get back, if you don't mind.
I mind very much.
Well, then I'd like a word with you anyhow. You know, it was very kind of you to offer to drive me back to, wherever my car happens to be.
I meant only to be civil, not kind.
I had an interesting talk this morning with Randolph. He thought very highly of Dr. Hudson.
Dr. Wayne Hudson inspired everyone he met.
He did have a remarkable influence over people, I suppose.
My husband understood the one important law of survival. He knew that man could continue to deserve life only so long as he lived to serve others. He believed in the power of unselfishness and in power from unselfishness.
Yeah, remarkable theory.
It's a working living theory. My husband discovered that Randolph had a talent for something better than carving gravestones, but he encouraged him to continue making memorials for the beloved dead. It wasn't art at first, but because it was in the service of plain, stricken, unhappy people, it became great, as my husband knew it must.
That's very interesting.
Oh, I know. You, to your worldly kind, there's no value in human sympathy, no virtue in unselfishness.
You know, you're beautiful.
Mr. Merrick, I think you'd better get out here.
Well, I've hardly talked to you.
There's nothing further to say.
I haven't had a fair chance to express myself in the unfortunate incident about your husband.
Incident? 1,000 people have lost their hope of happiness and even life itself, and you call it an incident.
Well, I only meant to try to...
Get out of this car.
Oh, why don't you melt?
Get out.
Please, look at that beautiful scenery.
Will you leave this car?
What a view. It's Arcadian. It's classic.
All right, then I'll get out.
Here, wait.
No, let go of my wrist.
Now, listen to me.
Let go, I tell you. Let go.
Oh, come on back. After all, I would... Look out! Look out for that car!
Joyce,
tell me.
I'll tell you.
Will she live?
She'll live. For the rest of her life, Helen will be blind.
Blind?
For as long as she lives. First my father, then Helen.
Blind.
Oh, why do people like you have to go on living? Why? Why?
On behalf of the American Heart Association, the NBC Theater is presenting the Screen Directors Guild production of Magnificent Obsession, starring Irene Dunne as Helen Hudson, with Willard Waterman as Robert Merrick.
Normal saline solution here, please.
Yes, Doctor.
I lie in darkness while the surgeons work about me, trying to turn the darkness into light for me again. I know I'm safe with them, safe and calm, and I think mistily of the warm days in the park, feeling the warmth of the sunshine that I could not see. I think of the little girl who used to meet me in the park to help me with my Braille lessons, for I was learning to read with my fingertips, to live in the darkness.
It was on a merry time when Jenny Wren was young, so neatly as she dressed and so sweetly as she sung. That doesn't even make sense to me. But it's your turn.
My dearest Jenny Wren, if you will but be mine, you shall dine on cherry pie.
Cherry pie.
And drink nice
currant
wine. I'll dress you like a... Like a... I'm stuck.
Goldfish.
Oh, no, that can't be right, can it? Goldfish?
Goldfinch.
Oh.
It's a kind of a bird.
Hello there.
Hello.
Susan, I thought we were alone.
Oh, him? He's here every day. Let's read some more.
No, I'd rather not today.
Tomorrow?
Yes, tomorrow.
Well... Okay. Take care of yourself.
All right. I'll be seeing you, Susan.
Bye, mister.
Yeah, so long, dear.
I didn't know anyone was near us.
Won't you let me help you with your reading?
No, I'd be embarrassed learning my ABCs with a grown-up.
Oh, before long, you'll be reading the classics in Braille. I have a friend who collects them. I'd like to bring them to you from time to time.
Oh, thank you, but I'd better learn my Mother Goose first. Are you interested in Braille?
Yes, very much.
You a doctor?
I just took my degree.
Oh, how nice. What's your name?
Robert.
Oh, Dr. Robert. I'm Helen Hudson. Well, now, I'd better hurry home.
I'll walk home with you.
No, it'll be out of your way.
No, it isn't far.
How do you know?
Well, I've watched you every day.
Oh.
May I?
Well, yes, thank you. Tell me something.
Sure, anything.
Have you ever been connected with Brightwood Hospital?
Brightwood? Why?
Your voice just seemed familiar, that's all. Day after day, he was there waiting for me, reading to me, as I learned to read with my fingertips. Day after day, he walked with me as far as my corner and no further. He never accepted my invitation to come in the house for a moment, never. Then one day, it rained furiously, and I didn't go out to our bench in the park. He telephoned me, and I was glad, for I had great news for him. But again, he wouldn't come over until I happened to mention that my stepdaughter, Joyce, was not at home. Then he consented to visit me. Only then.
Well, I had to come over when you hinted at this mysterious great news. Well, now, what is it?
Dr. Robert, I'm going to Paris. Four famous doctors have agreed to consult over my case. I suppose they mean it as a tribute to my husband, don't you?
Yes, I dare say. Well, then I won't be seeing you for a while.
No, but when I come back, perhaps I'll be seeing you.
Perhaps.
Well, Helen?
Oh, back so soon, Joyce? Oh,
it began to rain so hard, I just gave up the whole idea of...
Oh. Oh, Joyce Hudson, this is Dr. Robert. You've heard me speak about him.
Oh, yes.
Well, I was just about to go, Miss...
Let me go to the door with Dr. Robert.
Thank you.
Wish me luck.
Oh, I do. From the bottom of my heart, Helen.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bon voyage, darling. Ready, Joyce?
I'll write to you, Dr. Robert.
Goodbye.
Now, what is this, Bobby Merrick?
Don't use that name outside her door.
What's your game, Mr. Merrick?
Things have changed, Joyce. I've changed.
She hates Robert Merrick with all her soul. But she loves a voice named Dr. Robert. What's going to happen when she opens her eyes and sees you?
Perhaps she won't open her eyes.
You'd like that, wouldn't you?
Joyce. Joyce, I arranged for those specialists in Paris. I did.
That's even worse. Helen would rather be blind than owe her sight to Bobby Merrick.
Paris. Paris and hope. Paris and disillusion. Four great doctors looked into my eyes, examined x-rays, tested, asked questions, gave up. All the next day and into the early evening, I sat at the window of our hotel, hearing the voice of the city, listening to life and laughter in the streets, feeling so much and seeing nothing, and never hoping to see. Yes, come in, please. Joyce? Is that you, Joyce?
Helen.
Oh.
I had to come to you, Helen.
Dr. Robert, you came all this distance to... Oh, give me your hand. Let me see if you're real, if you're really here. Oh, yes, yes.
Are you so glad?
Glad? Oh. Dr. Robert, I'm not going to see, but... It's quite all right. No, really, I'm happy. I'm almost happier than I've ever been. Isn't it silly? Isn't it silly?
No, it isn't silly. And you are going to see.
They say no.
You're going to see the world, Helen, through my eyes. And we're going to start with Paris. I'm going to show you Paris. And I'm going to show Paris you.
All day, day after day, we saw Paris. Paris from the omnibus, the tower, the cathedral. Paris in the dawn, Paris in the murmuring dusk. Paris laughed and made the sounds of bells and violins. Paris glittered and sparkled and shone only as it shines for such as walk in darkness with a lover at her side. Then one evening, on the heights of Montmartre, the song of the city came up to us where we sat hand in hand on an ancient stone bench. I sat in darkness, my hand in his, and I was happy.
Helen, you're crying.
I know. Oh, I'm so happy, darling. So very happy.
Helen, could you ever again feel rancor or ill will for anyone? Anyone at all?
Never again for anyone, dearest.
I want you to be very sure, Helen.
I am sure, Robert.
You call me Robert?
Yes, darling.
You know, then.
I've known forever so long.
That I was Robert Merrick, the man who...
The man I love.
Helen. Oh, Helen, my dearest.
Please, Robert, please, don't be humble.
We're going to be married, Helen.
A blind woman for your wife. People would be sorry for you. Oh, no, I couldn't stand that.
Helen, I came to bring you home as my wife. I'm going to do what I set out to do.
Oh, Robert, darling. Let me answer you in the morning.
All right. In the morning, Helen. Remember.
Take me home, Robert. It's like a dream. A beautiful, beautiful dream. In the morning, Joyce and I left Paris. It was the only thing to do. For 6 long years, I did not see Robert again. I heard that he was abroad working, studying. And then one day, I received a note from him. Joyce read it to me. Only a few words. Dearest, I am a man possessed and obsessed. But I am not mad, only in love. Wait for me. I'm on my way. Robert Merrick, M.D. I feel nothing as I lie on the operating table. Only the sure elation of my love and of my trust in the man who works in darkness, calling for instruments. For Robert is with me, a Robert possessed, a Robert inspired, full of the medical wisdom of his years of study and understanding and love. Once he held aside the veil of darkness and I saw Paris, and he can brush the shadows from my eyes forever, if anyone can. For his is the power and the glory of those who live unselfishly for their fellow men.
Open your eyes. Helen?
Robert. I can see light.
Good. Each day will be brighter until one day soon, all the shadows will be washed away.
Robert. Robert.
Darling, you mustn't get excited.
All right, Robert. Can I get excited tomorrow?
The NBC Theater has presented the Screen Directors Guild production of Magnificent Obsession, starring Irene Dunne. Next week, the NBC Theater brings you another great motion picture story with its original team of director and star, John Cromwell and Ronald Coleman in the romantic adventure, The Prisoner of Zenda. Co-starring with Mr. Coleman will be Miss Benita Hume. And now, here again is tonight's star, speaking not as an actress, but as the woman's chairman of the American Heart Association, Irene Dunne.
Thank you very much. As you've been told, tonight's Screen Directors Guild production was presented on behalf of the American Heart Association. Tomorrow marks the beginning of National Heart Week, and a friend of mine has dropped into NBC Theater to tell you a little about it. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. John Lund.
Thank you. Thanks, Irene. Folks, next week the American Heart Association and the various local heart associations will be asking you for $5 million. But the real goal of the National Heart Week campaign isn't dollars, it's lives. Close to 600,000 lives which each year are snuffed out by heart disease. That's an awfully large figure, large enough to include you or a member of your family. So when you make your contribution to the Heart Association, you won't just be giving money away. You'll be buying something, research, a program of public education, and the most modern and efficient heart disease treatment to serve your own community. For example, rheumatic heart disease strikes hardest at our children. To protect the youngsters, the Heart Association is setting up an organization to examine the heart of every child in the land. I know the American heart is big enough to protect the hearts of its children. Don't let National Heart Week slip by without helping out. Good night.
Our thanks to Irene Dunn, John Lund, and screen director George Marshall. Also heard on tonight's program were Willard Waterman as Robert Merrick, Barbara Eiler, Ralph Moody, Dan Riss, and Ann Whitfield. Magnificent Obsession was adapted for radio by Milton Geiger, and original music was composed and directed by Henry Russell. Production was under the supervision of Howard Wiley, associate producer Bill Karn. Your announcer has been Frank Barton. Magnificent Obsession was presented through the courtesy of Universal International Pictures, now releasing The Fighting O'Flynn, starring Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and Helena Carter. Irene Dunne is currently starring in the RKO production, I Remember Mama, the picture which has won her nomination for the Academy Award. Listen again next week when the NBC Theater presents...
Screen Directors Guild Assignment, production The Prisoner of Zenda, director John Cromwell, stars... Ronald Coleman, Benita Hume.
Kiddies, wasn't that scary? That really was scary. And now they're going to be husband and wife. Brr. It seemed to happen so quickly, too. She's only been seeing him for such a short time, huh? Yes, I guess it just goes to show that love is blind, huh? Oh, but then again, it's not as if he didn't try to expedite the process. After all, he's one smooth operator, huh? Yes. Well, that's one doctor who doesn't have to grope in the dark, huh? It sure sounded like serious surgery. I wonder how many scars it left. One thing's for certain, if she was ugly before, by now she's a seeing-eye dog, huh? Hey, say, I think I hear her in the background now. Yes, they never did tell us how she looked. But then again, if she were blind, I guess she couldn't, huh? But everything appears to be all right now. You might even say she has a bright future ahead of her, huh? Oh, yes. One thing I do hope, though, I just hope she doesn't lose sight of her past, huh? Yes, yes. Actually, I shouldn't make fun of blindness because vampires can get sick too. In fact, we all have chronic diarrhea.
Yes.
I'm afraid so. You could say that it, how could I put it frankly? Runs in the family, huh? Afraid so, but our doctors, they can't cure us. They say, what do you expect from an all-liquid diet, huh? Fortunately, I only have one relative with a sight problem, and he only suffers from it sometimes. I say sometimes because he's only blind as a bat, huh?
Weird circle. In this cave by the restless sea, we are met to call from out of the past stories, strange and weird. Bellkeeper, toll the bell, so that all may know we are gathered again in the Weird Circle.
speak again their immortal tale, The Hauler.
It was a dark house, dreary too. Shadows crept down the walls like loathsome vermin. The house was old and filled with memories of better days, like the man who lived there. He was old and gnarled and alone. He'd passed the lonely hours by sitting on the porch of his home, watching the boats sail up and down the river. He was happy living alone in that old house. Until one day, a tall, three-rigged Brazilian schooner floated past his shores, casting a shadow on the banks of the river. A shadow over the old house. A shadow over the old man. A living shadow which crept into his mind. He wrote a letter to his young cousin, Madame Renée Sable, who was living in Paris, begging her to visit him. He read the letter over several times, then took it to a friend of hers, a doctor, Dr. Parent, to ask his advice. She was young and in Paris, and she didn't believe in the old man's shadow.
I had to come to you, Dr. Parent, because this letter worries me so. You've known my cousin, Gabriel Bouvet, for a long time, and he's not the sort of man given to hallucinations.
He seems to be a very sound old man. But living alone the way he does...
Nonsense. Living alone has nothing to do with it.
But suppose you read me the letter, Madame Saar.
Of course. It all seems like so much poppycock. Listen. Be honored by a visit from you at your earliest convenience. Isn't that like him?
Yes, very much.
You'll find me a changed man, my dear. Changed because he has come. You don't know what I'm talking about, and so I must explain. A shadow has crept into my home, a shadow which dominates me. You see what I mean, Doctor.
Well, read on, Renée.
Right. He is a creature from a land of shadows, but I tell you, he does live. He lives here with me, and I'm afraid of him. Oh, Renée, he will dominate all of mankind, just as mankind has dominated the animal kingdom. We will become his chattel, his food and his slave, as the animals become ours. You see, Doctor?
Yes, indeed I do. I wonder... Renée, how soon can you pack and be ready to leave?
In about 2 hours.
Well, fine. I'll have the horse and buggy hitched and call for you then. I think we'd better go down to him as soon as possible.
Doctor, surely you don't believe in this invisible creature.
Well, surely, Renée, I don't doubt the wind just because I can't see it. We'll be able to judge better after we have a talk with him. You better hurry home. I'm going right down to the stables now.
It's been a long trip, Doctor. I hope we don't frighten my cousin by coming at this hour.
That's his house right over there, isn't it?
Yes, right at the end of the road.
Huh. Gloomy-looking old place.
Very gloomy. It's so dark and so very old.
Tell me, how long has Bouvet's wife been dead?
About 6 years now.
Did you notice any perceptible change in him after she died?
Nothing exceptional. Except he became quieter and grew into himself more, mm-hmm. if that's possible. Well, here we are.
Yeah. Oh, there, boy. Oh.
And so the doctor and the old man's cousin, Renée Sub, entered the old house, expecting to find a man weakened by illness, haggard with lack of sleep. But instead, Gabriel Bouvet was in high spirits as he conducted his guest into the house. He made a special pot of tea, and then as he passed the cream and sugar.
Drink your tea, Renée. Stop being so nervous. Fidget, fidget. Always were a fidgety youngster. Makes me nervous.
You were talking about the Brazilian boat, Monsieur Bouvet. What has the boat to do with this unknown shadow?
You don't know, then?
Frankly, no.
Well, here. Look at this book.
Well?
Study of the scientific world. Open it. My eyes aren't as good as they used to be, or I'd read it to you myself. Page 72.
What has this to do with the shadow which you see?
Allow your friend the doctor to read the second paragraph.
Hmm. Well, listen to this, Renée. Sao Paulo, Brazil. A contagious madness has spread throughout Sao Paulo. The victims claim they are being possessed by creatures of darkness who feed only on milk and water. medical servants have been rushed to their aid.
But that's in Brazil, cousin.
I know, I know. That the Brazilian boat sailed by my door. It's possible for this, whatever it is, to have escaped from the boat.
Well, anything's possible, but this does seem a little improbable.
But possession, that's talking of demons. This is a modern world. No one man can possess the power of ordering another's will.
How little you know, cousin.
Well, perhaps I am a fool of a girl, but anybody...
No, not anybody, Renee. Not me, for instance. I believe in hypnotics and possession of a kind.
Dr. Mesmer's nonsense. I don't believe in mesmerism.
Well, I can prove it to you simply enough.
How?
If you're willing, we'll try a little experiment.
You hypnotize?
If you'll be a subject.
Why, of course I will. That sounds like fun.
Can I help in any way, Doctor?
Yes, just blow out the candle. All but one.
Certainly. I'll leave the corner candle on.
All right now, Renee, if you'll close your eyes.
My eyes are closed.
And try to sleep. Sleep.
There. Candles are out. All but one.
Now, sleep, my dear. Try to sleep.
Doctor. Listen. Listen to that.
What? What, monsieur?
It's in the room. I know it is. It's here, next to me, watching me. Can't you hear it crying, crying?
This is madness.
You don't believe me, do you? Stop the experiment at once. Listen.
Cousin, please.
What makes you think mankind is the final answer to life? Perhaps there is a higher form of life. A form of life which can possess us and then destroy us. Isn't that possible, Doctor?
Well, yes, anything is possible.
Then take my word for it. Humanity is lost unless we destroy it. Look. I always carry a knife with me, waiting for the time I can destroy him. Listen. It's come for me. Come for possession of me. It's come. It's the horror. The horror. And it's come.
Doctor, won't he ever wake up? He's been unconscious for over an hour.
Well, it's best to let him sleep right now, my dear. This is an exhausting emotional strain for a man of his years.
But what can we do?
As soon as his heartbeat is normal, I'll take him back to the Paris hospital. You'll have to stay here for a few days and close the house. Just pack his belongings and bring them on to Paris as soon as you can.
Anything you say, Dr. Parr.
Well, come, Renee. We must let him sleep. I'll prepare the coach for the return journey. And so they left him, lying on the old bed in his room. And the shadows on the walls cast purple shadows on his gnarled hands. And the hands clutched the air and thrashed the sheets as if the old man were fighting. Fighting a being, fighting a presence, fighting for possession of his own will. The old man's face was a mask of horror. And then the wind, that strange, unholy wind, started to sneak in the room. It oozed through the door, the keyhole, and the window. It slid to the bedside.
No. No.
You're possessed. Possessed and down.
I know you watch me night and day.
Night and day. Night and day.
But I'll get away from you. I've got to get away from you. I won't give in without a struggle.
You'll have to give in because nobody believes you. Believes you. Believes you.
Leave me alone. Leave me alone.
Watching you, watching you, watching
you. Leave me alone.
I'll never leave you alone. Never, never, never.
But I shall be free of you.
You can't be free of me. I'm part of you.
If I stay here...
They'll call you mad. They'll call you mad.
But if I leave the house...
You'll die.
I'll leave you here. You can't follow me. I'll go far away. So far, nobody will find me.
Oh, I've got one hand on your heart, Bouvet, and one in the room. If you leave, your heart will be torn from you, torn from your body, torn from your soul.
Monsieur Bouvet, is anything the matter?
I heard him scream, too. Huh? Doctor, look at him.
Oh.
His face is dead white.
Yes, Renee, you're quite right. I'll have to risk moving him now. I don't think we ought to leave him in this house any longer.
But how can you travel alone with him?
Well, I'll manage somehow. I'll carry him to the buggy. He can sleep as we drive along. I can manage somehow.
That is, if you don't mind staying here alone.
Oh, I don't mind, Doctor. I have no patience with superstitious nonsense.
Here, my dear, help me wrap him in this blanket.
Of course, Doctor.
There, that's fine. Now hand me that other blanket over there.
Here you are.
That'll keep him warm on the journey. I'll send the coach back from Paris tomorrow evening to pick you up. You ought to be able to leave here by then.
Don't worry about me, Dr. Perron. I'll be all right.
That's what she thought then. But even as the doctor carried the old man out of the house to the carriage, a premonition of fear, a foreboding, reached out from the gathering shadows in the walls and left her trembling and weak. The doctor placed the old man in the carriage. And then that journey and the return to Paris started. They had traveled for about an hour. They awakened, sobbing out.
You've taken me away. Away from my house, you fool.
Obey, you must not excite yourself.
Put his hands on my heart and he's pulling on it, pulling on it. Doctor, take me back before I die.
Nonsense, Obey. You must get away from that place.
Take me back. Take me back, Doctor. You don't understand.
Obey, sit down.
You think I'm mad, don't you? But the hall exists. They exist and I'll die if I don't get done.
Will you try to rest, Monsieur? We're doing everything we can for you.
Turn the carriage around, Doctor. And it's under the house.
Uwe, put those reins
Listen,
down.
Me.
Let go of the reins, you fool, before you take us off the road.
Turn the carriage around.
I shall plunge this knife into you.
Uwe, put that knife down. Put that down.
That will teach you to interfere with a hauler, Doctor.
No.
That will teach you.
No.
Now, get out of this carriage, Doctor.
But, Uwe.
Before I plunge the dagger into your heart.
Uwe. Well, but you can't leave me here like this.
I must leave you here. I must return to the house at once to destroy him.
But he doesn't exist except in your own mind, Bouvet.
He exists, and I'm going to him.
Bouvet!
Doctor. Dead. I'm coming, Master. I'm coming, Master. I'm coming to destroy you, just as I destroyed him.
So Bouvet drove off in the rambling carriage, leaving the badly wounded doctor lying on the roadside, more dead than alive. Bouvet drove furiously through the night to a little shack about a half mile from his home. There was a sign on the shack, a sign reading, "Littal's Expert Lockmakers and Ironworkers." Bouvet pulled the carriage up in front of the door. He walked to the entrance of the shack.
Monsieur Littal! Who's calling at this? Oh, Monsieur Bouvet. What are you doing at this hour of the night? Yes, of course. I need your help, that's what. My help? What can a poor man like me do for a wealthy man like you? You can make a lock for me. I've got to lock the doors of my house securely. The front and back doors and the windows. All the windows in my house. It must be locked and bolted, Littal. Tonight? Yes, tonight, you fool. Of course, tonight. But in heaven's name, why? To lock him out of my home, out of my life. You're not... Into an eternity. You're not feeling well? Come, Littal. Don't bicker with me. Hurry, man. I'm prepared to pay any price you ask. Of course. She'll be as you say if you'll only just give me time to get my instruments together. Of course, but hurry, Littal. Hurry. He's waiting for me now.
Monsieur Littal and the old man returned to the lonely old house by the river in the dead of the night. They crept into the house and worked in the half-darkness near the shadows. And that strange, unholy wind was quiet and didn't disturb them while they worked. Bouvet felt safe and free for a while, only a while. And a girl slept upstairs, slept undisturbed and quiet. The hours passed this way, passed quietly,
as the locksmith worked, and the old man muttered.
Hey, look, hey. It's almost morning.
I'm hurrying as fast as I can. I'm almost done, except for the windows in your cousin's room.
Well, don't worry about her. I'll wake her up when the time comes. Finish that lock, man.
Just two more nails will hold it in place.
Good, good, good. Two more nails. Two more nails.
There you are.
What are you doing here?
Good morning, youngster. Good morning, my dear.
But the doctor was to take you.
Away from my house. But he couldn't, Renee.
Where is the doctor?
In Paris. He's going to return this evening after my work is done.
Yes. Yes. A job in life. Kill the whore.
The doctor let you return alone?
He had to let me. But I wasn't alone.
Who is this?
I'm Monsieur Littow, mademoiselle, the most famous lockmaker in the world.
I don't understand all this.
Naturally, my dear. Come along, Littow. You must finish your work. Only two more locks to fix tonight. And I'll be able to lock him in and kill him. Kill him. Hell, what are you staring at me for? Go ahead to my cousin's room and start to work.
Of course, I'll start right away.
Gabrielle. Look at me, cousin.
I'm looking at you, Renee. I see you.
Are you lying to me?
Why should I lie to you?
What did you do to the doctor?
Nothing, nothing, Renee. With
that knife in your belt. What about that knife in your belt?
I always carry a knife to protect me against the horror.
There's blood on that knife, Gabrielle. What did you do?
Be quiet.
Cousin, am I all gone?
I can't let you go.
What are you going to do to me?
I have to bind you up. Tie to a chair until I've killed him. Don't you understand? Yes, I'm old, but I'm strong, cousin. Stronger than you. Oh, no, don't struggle against me.
Gabrielle, you in trouble? I thought I heard you.
You heard nothing. Nothing, monsieur. Go back to work.
All right, I'm almost done.
Now, come along, cousin. I'll have to tie you in the kitchen where you'll be out of harm's way. Until he's dead.
Beauvais dragged his cousin to the kitchen, and then taking a stout rope, tied her to the kitchen table by the sheer strength of a maniac, tied her securely, and then threw a tablecloth over her. Smiling to himself, he left the kitchen and went to the upstairs room to watch Littow finish the work of the night.
Are you finished, Monsieur Littow?
Yes, yes, of course, yes, I'm finished.
Here. Here you are, Littow. 200 francs for one night's work. Good pay, isn't it?
Very good pay, Monsieur Beauvais, very good pay. Anything more I can do, sir?
Have you locked the locks?
All locks secured, Monsieur.
I'm glad. Hey, Littow, what are you waiting for? Why don't you go home?
I thought I ought to say good night to the
young lady. There's no need, sir. I'll say good night for you.
Listen. Hear that? I hear nothing. Naturally.
You hear nothing.
Good night, Monsieur Beauvais.
Littow, may I caution you against one thing?
Of course.
Don't tell anybody of this work tonight. Do you understand? Don't tell anybody.
Of course I understand. Good night. See you in the morning.
Your locks can't lock me out.
You again.
I've been watching you and your lockmaker, watching you, and your locks are useless. Locks are useless, useless.
But I can lock you in when I escape.
Impossible, because I am with you constantly.
And I'll destroy you, horror.
With a knife?
No, with fire and flame. I'll set the entire house on fire and leave you here. Leave you here and I'll escape. You can't escape. You're part of this house, you said to yourself.
Did I now? How interesting. How interesting. How very interesting.
And you'll burn to death. You'll burn to death. And the world will be free of the horror.
Are you so sure, Beauvais? Are you so sure?
I'll pour oil on the walls and on the rugs and on the floor. Where's the oil?
In the kitchen closet.
Yes, in the kitchen closet. That's where it is.
Don't forget I'm part
of you. No, no. You'll be destroyed by fire.
And while the frantic, distraught old man poured oil on the rugs and on the walls, Littow walked slowly home, worrying about his old friend Beauvais, worrying about the strangest actions he'd ever seen, worrying and trying to fit together the odd pieces of the puzzle in his mind. Halfway home, he heard a voice cry out,
"Somebody help! Help before it's too late!"
Who is it? Oh, but it's the doctor. Oh. What's his name? What has happened to you?
Help!
Oh, you're badly wounded. Here, allow me to help you stand on your feet. There now.
Oh, I'm so weak.
What happened?
The madman, Bouvet. I was trying to take him to a hospital and he stabbed me.
Madman? I thought so. I just finished making 24 sets of locks for him and his house.
Littow, is Madame Saab still there?
Yes. I thought I heard her cry out, but I wasn't sure.
Well, we must get help to her immediately. That madman will do anything. Anything, Littow.
Here, let me carry you, monsieur. There, put your arm over my shoulder if you can. We'll get help as soon as possible.
Hurry. Hurry, Littow. Hurry, man.
Yeah. Now I've poured oil over the entire house. The entire house. The curtains, the ceiling. Even the beds and walls and the chairs. Now for a match. Yes, one match. One match in the house will go up in flames. Flames. And you'll be dead.
Will I be dead? Will I?
I need a match. I need a match. Must be a match in the kitchen. And the house will all be flames. Flames. And you will burn. Burn and die. Yeah. Don't be nervous, cousin. Don't be nervous. Work is almost done, almost done. We'll be dead. The hall will be dead. Dead, yes. Here, take a match. And I've got my flames on the top floor.
The top floor?
Don't follow me. I don't want you following me.
I like to watch you.
Up those stairs. Yes. Up the stairs to the landing. Yeah. Will you enjoy watching your own funeral pyre?
Fire and flames. Fire and flame.
Yeah, I'm almost to the top now. And then I'll strike my match. And the flames will start.
How do you intend to escape? Don't forget your own escape.
Yes. Yes. I escape, my escape. I must escape. I'll unlock the front door and run out. Just in time. And you'll be trapped. Here we are. Now, light the match. Light the match.
No, no, Bouvet.
Hey, Paula. You'll die here.
Be careful of yourself. Be careful of yourself. I don't want any harm to come to you, Bouvet.
Look. Look. The fire started. Look at the flames. Look at the walls and the shadows. Look at the flames. Now for the downstairs.
I'm right beside you. Where you go, I go.
No, no. You must stay here and die. Don't you understand? And you will die.
Watch out for the flames. Watch out for the flames.
I must light the match down here now. Light the canopy. Like that. How do you like those flames, Ola? How do you like those flames?
Be careful of yourself, Bouvet. Be careful of yourself.
Now one last light here. And the job is done. And I'll wait and escape. At the last minute. And you'll be left.
Okay, open up now. They've come to rescue me, you see, Bouvet. They've come to rescue me.
No, no. I won't open up. Hurry, please. Hurry. Don't let them beat you to the job.
I tell you, the girl's in the back of the house.
Leave the door down.
Get the girl.
Where is she?
She's in the back of the house. Hurry, men.
They're all fools. They're allowing the horror to live. They're allowing the horror to escape.
Watch out, Bouvet.
I've got the girl. He would have died in here. And I would have been free.
I'll never leave you, old friend.
And I would have been free.
Never free me.
Don't you see him? He's standing next to me.
Always next to you. Always next to
and
you.
And he's to die in the flames.
Only if you die in the flames.
Watch out, the hustle.
Let out. Let out.
If I die in the flames. Yes, of course. I must die in the flames. Yes. I must die in the flames. And then the horror will be dead.
And the old wild-eyed man rushed into the pile of burning timber among his old belongings and perished there. He and the horror perished there. All that remained of the man and the horror was scorched bones. And 2 odd, misshapen skulls. 2 odd, misshapen skulls. Remember that. For there were 2 skulls, not 1.
From the time-worn pages of the past, we have heard another immortal tale in The Weird Circle. Bellkeeper, toll the bell. Be here in this lonely cave by the restless sea once again next time for another immortal tale in The Weird Circle.
The Weird Circle is distributed exclusively by Nostalgia Broadcasting Corporation, Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Kids, was it scary or what? What? Of course it was. That creepy old man, he must have been crazy or something. Either that or he was terribly high on his spirits, huh? Too bad the expensive house had to go in flames. No doubt that means a big chunk of the inheritance went up in smoke too, huh? Yes, I guess it just goes to show that you can bake it with you, huh? And all the time, the old man was afraid his heart would be yanked out by the demon. Instead, he died of heartburn, huh? he shouldn't have been so mean. After all, when you treat people like doo-doo, you're bound to end up an asshole.
The Columbia Network takes pleasure in bringing you Suspense. Suspense, Columbia's parade of outstanding thrillers, produced and directed by William Spear and scored by Bernard Herrmann. The notable melodramas from stage and screen, fiction and radio, presented each week to bring you to the edge of your chair, to keep you in suspense. Good evening.
This is Orson Welles. I'm very happy I am to be back in the United States and back on the Columbia Network, even for so short a visit as this one. Back with old friends like Johnny Dietz, who's tonight's director, and Bernard Herrmann. The Mercury Theater presented tonight's radio play for the first time last year. They came right out then and hailed it as a classic of the medium. Nobody argued the point. A lot of people asked us to do it again, so it's gratifying to get the chance now. And to find a favorite of ours in this distinguished anthology of spook shows. Personally, I've never met anybody who didn't like a good ghost story. But I know a lot of people who think there are a lot of people who don't like a good ghost story. For the benefit of these, at least, I go on record at the outset of this evening's entertainment with a sober assurance that although blood may be curdled on this program, none will be spilt. There's no shooting, knifing, throttling, axing, or poisoning here. No clanking chains, no cobwebs, no bony and or hairy hands appearing from secret panels or, better yet, bedroom curtains. If it's any part of that dear old phosphorescent foolishness that people who don't like ghost stories don't like, then again, I promise you, we haven't got it. Not tonight. What we do have is a thriller. It's half as good as we think it is. You can call it a shocker. It's already been called a real Orson Welles story. Now, frankly, I don't know what this means. I've been on the air directing and acting in my own shows for quite a while now, and I don't suppose I've done more than half a dozen thrillers in all that time. Honestly, I don't think even that many, but it seems I do have a reputation for the uncanny. Quite possibly, a little escapade of mine involving a couple of planets, which shall be nameless, is responsible. Doesn't really matter. Don't think I disapprove of thrillers. I don't. A story doesn't have to appeal to the heart. It can also appeal to the spine. Sometimes you want your heart to be warmed, and sometimes you want your spine to tingle. The tingling, it's to be hoped, will be quite audible as you listen tonight to The Hitchhiker. That's the name of our story, The Hitchhiker. I'm in an auto camp on Route 66, just west of Gallup, New Mexico. I tell her, perhaps it'll help me. Keep me from going crazy. I gotta tell this quickly. I'm not crazy now. I feel perfectly well, except that I'm running a slight temperature. My name is Ronald Adams. I'm 36 years of age, unmarried, tall, dark, with a black mustache. I drive a 1940 Buick, license number 6Y175189. I was born in Brooklyn. All this I know. I know that I'm at this moment perfectly sane. That it's not me who's gone mad. It's something else. Something utterly beyond my control. I'll just speak quickly. At any minute, the link may break. This may be the last thing I ever tell on Earth. The last night I ever see the stars. 6 days ago, I left Brooklyn to drive to California.
Goodbye, Sally. Good luck to you, my boy.
Goodbye, Mother. Here, give me a kiss. And I'll go.
I'll come out with you to the car.
Oh, no, it's raining. See you at the door. Hey, what's this? Tears? I thought you'd promised me you wouldn't cry.
I know, dear. I'm sorry. But I do hate to see you.
I'll be back. It'll always be on the course 3 months.
Oh, it isn't that. It's just a trip. Ronald, I wish you weren't driving.
Oh, Mother, there you go again. People do it every day.
I know, but you're a bit careful, won't you? Promise me you'll be extra careful. Don't fall asleep or drive fast or pick up any strangers on the road.
Oh, gosh. I think I was still 17 here, you talk.
Oh. And why? I mean, as soon as you get to Hollywood, won't you, son?
Of course I will. Don't you worry. If anything's going to happen, it's 8 days of perfectly simple driving on smooth, decent, civilized roads. With a hot dog or a hamburger stand every day. Fine skirts. The drive ahead of me, even the loneliness, seemed like a lark. I reckoned without him. Crossing Brooklyn Bridge that morning in the rain, I saw a man leaning against the cables. He seemed to be waiting for a lift. There were spots of fresh rain on his shoulders. He was carrying a cheap overnight bag in one hand. He was thin, nondescript, with a cap pulled down over his eyes. I would have forgotten him completely, except that just an hour later, while crossing the Pulaski Skyway over the Jersey Flats, I saw him again. At least, he looked like the same person. He was standing now with one thumb pointing west. I couldn't figure out how he'd got there, but I thought probably one of those fast trucks had picked him up, beat me to the Skyway, and let him off. I didn't stop for him. Then late that night, I saw him again. It's on the new Pennsylvania Turnpike between Harrisburg and Pittsburgh. It's 265 miles long with a very high speed limit. I was just slowing down for one of the tunnels when I saw him standing under an arc light by the side of the road. I'd seen quite distinctly the bag, the cap, even the spots of fresh rain scattered over his shoulders. He hallooed at me this time. Gas like a shot. That's lonely country for the Alleghenies, and I had no intention of stopping. Besides, the coincidences, or whatever it was, maybe the Willies, stopped at the next gas station.
Yes, sir.
Fill her up.
Certainly, sir. Check your oil, sir?
No, thanks. Yes. It hasn't been raining here recently, has it?
Not a drop of rain all week.
Oh? Oh, I suppose that doesn't do your business any harm.
Oh, people drive through here all kinds of weather. Mostly business, you know. There aren't many pleasure cars out on the turnpike this season of the year.
I suppose not. What about hitchhikers?
Hitchhikers here?
What's the matter? Don't you ever see any?
Not much. If we did, it'd be a sight for sore eyes.
Why?
Oh, a guy'd be a fool who started out to hitch rides on this road. Look at it.
Then, you've never seen anybody?
Nope.
Maybe they get the lift before the turnpike starts. I mean, you know, just before the toll house. But then it'd be a mighty long ride. Most cars wouldn't want to pick up a guy for that long a ride. And you know, this is pretty lonesome country here. Mountains and woods. You ain't seen anybody like that, have you?
No. Oh, no, not at all. I've just a technical question.
I see. Well, that'll be just $1.49 with the tax.
Gradually passed through my mind a sheer coincidence. I had a good night's sleep in Pittsburgh. I didn't think about the man all next day until just outside of Zanesville, Ohio, I saw him again. It was a bright, sunshiny afternoon. The peaceful Ohio fields, brown with the autumn stubble, lay greening in the golden light. I was driving slowly, drinking it in, when the road suddenly ended in a detour. In front of the barrier, he was standing. Let me explain about his appearance before I go on. I repeat, there was nothing sinister about him. He was as drab as a mud fence, nor was his attitude menacing. He merely stood there, waiting, almost drooping a little, the cheap overnight bag in his hand. He looked as though he'd been waiting there for hours. And he looked up. He hailed me. He started to walk forward.
Hello! Hello! Hello?
No, not just now, sorry.
Going to California?
No, not today. The other way, going to New York, sorry. After I got the car back on the road again, I felt like a fool. Yet the thought of picking him up, of having him sit beside me, was somehow unbearable. At the same time, I felt more than ever unspeakably alone. Hour after hour went by. Fields, the towns ticked off one by one. The light changed. I knew now that I was going to see him again. And though I dreaded the sight, I caught myself searching the side of the road, waiting for him to appear. Sandwiches and pop here, don't you?
Yeah, we do in the daytime. We're closed up now for the
night. I know, but I was wondering if you could possibly have a cup of coffee, black coffee. Just
no, not this time of night, mister. My wife's a cook. She's a man.
Don't shut the door, please. Listen, just a minute ago. just a minute ago, there was a man standing here right beside the stand, a suspicious looking man. I don't mean to disturb it. You see, I was driving along when I just happened to look, and there he was.
How was he doing?
Well, nothing.
You've been taking a nip, that's what you've been doing. Now, on your way before I call out Sheriff Oates.
I got into the car again and drove on slowly. Beginning to hate the car. If I could have found a place to stop, to rest a little. I was in the Ozark Mountains of Missouri now. A few resort places there were closed, only an occasional log cabin, seemingly deserted. That's all that broke the monotony of the wild, wooded landscape. I had seen him at that roadside stand. I knew I'd see him again. Maybe at the next turn of the road. I knew that when I saw him next, I would run him down. I didn't see him again. I didn't see him until late next afternoon. Stopped a car at a sleepy little junction just across the border into Oklahoma to let a train pass by. When he appeared across the tracks, leaning against a telephone pole. Perfectly airless, dry day. The red clay of Oklahoma was baking under the southwestern sun. Yet there were spots of fresh rain on his shoulders. I couldn't stand that. Without thinking, blindly, I started the car across the tracks. He didn't look up at me. He was staring at the ground. I stepped on the gas hard, bearing the wheel sharply toward him. I could hear the train in the distance now, but I didn't care. And
wrong with the car. The train was coming closer. I could hear its bell ringing and the cry of its whistle. Still, he stood there. And now I knew that he was beckoning me to my death. In that time. The starter worked at last. I managed to back up. When the train passed, he was gone. I was all alone in the hot, dry afternoon. After that, I knew I had to do something. I didn't know who this man was or what he wanted of me. I only knew that from now on, I mustn't let myself alone on the road for 1 minute. Hello there. Like a ride?
Well, what do you think? How far are you going?
Where do you want to go?
Amarillo, Texas.
I'll drive you there.
Gee. You mind if I take off my shoes? My dogs are killing me.
Go right ahead.
Oh, gee, what a break this is.
You hitchhike much?
Sure, only it's tough sometimes in these great open spaces to get the break.
I should think it would be, though. I'll bet you get a good pickup in a fast car. If you did, you could get places faster than, say, another person in another car, couldn't you?
I don't get you.
Well, take me, for instance. Suppose I'm driving across the country, say, at a nice steady clip, about 45 miles an hour. Couldn't a girl like you just standing beside the road waiting for a lift beat me to town, or any town, provided she got picked up every time in a car doing from 65 to 70 miles an hour?
I don't know. What difference does it make?
Oh, no difference. It's just a crazy idea I had sitting here in the car.
Imagine spending your time in a swell car thinking of things like that.
What would you do instead?
What would I do? If I was a good-looking fella like yourself, why, I just enjoy myself every minute of the time. I'd sit back and relax. And if I saw a good-looking girl along the side of the road, hey, look out!
Did you see it?
See who?
Man standing beside the barbed wire fence.
I didn't see anybody. There wasn't nothing but a bunch of cows and the wire fence.
No?
What'd you think he was doing? Trying to run into the barbed wire fence?
There was a man there, I tell you. A thin gray man with an overnight bag in his hand. And I was trying to run him down.
Run him down? You mean kill him?
Say you didn't see him back there? You sure?
I didn't see a soul. As far as
watch
that's
for him the next time, and keep watching. Keep your eyes peeled on the road. He'll turn up again. Maybe any minute. There! Look there!
How does this door work? I'm getting out
of
here.
Did you see him that time?
No, I didn't see him that time. And personally, mister, I don't expect never to see him. All I want to do is go on living. I don't see how I will very long, driving with you.
Oh, I'm sorry, I don't know what came over me, but please don't go.
So if you'll excuse me...
You can't go. Listen, how would you like to go to California? I'll drive you to California.
Seeing pink elephants all the way? No, thanks. Thanks just the same.
Listen, please, just 1 minute, please.
You know what I think you need, big boy? Not a girlfriend. Just a good dose of sleep.
Please.
There. I got it now.
No, you can't go. Please, come
your
back.
Hands off me. Do you hear me? Leave your hands off me.
She ran from me. As though I were a monster. A few minutes later, I saw a passing truck pick her up. I knew then that I was utterly alone. It was in the heart of the great Texas prairies. There wasn't a car on the road after the truck went by. I tried to figure out what to do, how to get hold of myself. I could find a place to rest, or even if I could sleep right here in the car for a few hours along the side of the road. Getting my winter overcoat out of the back seat to use as a blanket when I saw him coming toward me, emerging from the herd of moving steer.
Hello!
Maybe I should have spoken to him then. Fought it out then and there. For now he began to be everywhere. Whenever I stopped, even for a moment, for gas, for oil, for a drink of pop, a cup of coffee, sandwich, he was there. I saw him standing outside the auto camp in Amarillo that night when I dared to slow down. Sitting near the drinking fountain of a little camping spot just inside the border of New Mexico. He was waiting for me outside the Navajo reservation where I stopped to check my tires. I saw him in Albuquerque when I bought 20 gallons of gas. I was afraid to stop now. I began to drive faster and faster. I was in lunar landscape now. The great arid mesa country of New Mexico. I drove through it with the indifference of a fly crawling over the face of the moon. Now he didn't even wait for me to stop. Unless I drove at 85 miles an hour over those endless roads, he waited for me at every other mile. I'd see his figure, shadowless, flitting before me, still in the same attitude, over the cold, lifeless ground, flitting over dried-up rivers, over broken stones cast up by old glacial upheavals, flitting in that pure and cloudless air. I was beside myself when I finally reached Gallup, New Mexico this morning. There's an auto camp here. Cold, almost deserted this time of year. I went inside and asked if there was a telephone. I had the feeling that if only I could speak to someone familiar, someone I loved, I could pull myself together.
Your call, please.
Long distance.
Long distance, certainly. This is long distance.
I'd like to put in a call to my home in Brooklyn, New York. I'm Ronald Adams. The number is Beechwood 200828.
Certainly. I will try to get it for you. Albuquerque. New York for Gallup.
New York.
Gallup, New Mexico, calling Beechwood 200828.
I read somewhere that love could banish demons. The middle of the morning. My new mother would be home. I pictured her tall and white-haired in her crisp house dress, going about her tasks. It'd be enough, I thought, just to hear the even calmness of her voice.
Will you please deposit $3.85 for the first 3 minutes? When you have deposited a dollar and a half, will you wait until I have collected the money? All right, deposit another dollar and a half. Will you please deposit the remaining 85 cents? Ready with Brooklyn. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
This is Adams' residence.
Hello, Mother.
This is Mrs. Adams' residence. Who is it you wish to speak to, please?
What? Oh, who is this?
This is Mrs. Winnie.
Mrs. Winnie? I don't know any Mrs. Winnie. Is this Beechwood 208828?
Yes.
Where's my mother? Where's Mrs. Adams?
Mrs. Adams is not at home. She's still in the hospital.
The hospital?
Yes. Who is this calling, please? Is it a member of the family?
Well, what's she in the hospital for?
She's been prostrated for 5 days. Nervous breakdown. But who is this
nervous
calling?
Breakdown? Well, my mother never was nervous.
It's all taken place since the death of her oldest son, Ronald.
Death of her oldest son, Ronald? Hey, what's this? What number is this?
This is Beechwood 20828. It's all been very sudden. He was killed just 6 days ago in an automobile accident on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Your 3 minutes are up, sir. Your 3 minutes are up, sir. Your 3 minutes are up, sir.
And so... So I'm sitting here in this deserted auto camp in Gallup, New Mexico. I'm trying to think. Trying to get hold of myself. Otherwise, I'm going to go crazy. Outside, it's night. The vast, soulless night of New Mexico. A million stars are in the sky. Ahead of me stretch 1,000 miles of empty mesa. Mountains. Prairies. Desert. Somewhere among them, he's waiting for me. Somewhere I shall know who he is and who I am. The Hitchhiker, and to Orson Welles our considerable thanks for his playing of the title role. Mr. Welles, help wanted. Men, women, and children. Nature of work, hard, monotonous, back-breaking labor. Hours, 75 a week minimum. Pay, few cents an hour. Added inducement, 2 meals a day, including several ounces of bad bread and a cup of thin soup. Don't delay, apply at once. How'd you respond to a want ad like that, Mr. and Mrs. American working man and woman? You'd laugh, wouldn't you, and throw the paper in the trash basket. Dismiss the whole advertisement as some kind of a joke. But believe me, it's no joke. It's a simple statement of the working conditions that exist today in Nazi Germany and the conquered countries under Nazi rule. It's also an exact statement of the working conditions that'll be imposed on you and every member of your family if the Nazis win this war. You yourself personally can stop them from winning, as you know. You don't have to give up your well-paid job to do it. You needn't have to be a soldier or a sailor or an airman or a nurse or a war worker to ensure American victory. Uncle Sam doesn't ask plain, ordinary, hard-working citizens like you to give him anything. All he asks, all this he does ask very seriously and very urgently, is that you loan him 10 cents out of every dollar you make. That's all there is to it. Lend Uncle Sam a dime to win this war, and he'll pay you back with interest when he's won it. The easiest, most convenient way to lend in these dimes is to enroll in the payroll savings plan. Just tell your boss to deduct 10 cents from every dollar he pays you and lend it to Uncle Sam in your name. Sign up for this simple savings plan today, and when victory comes, you'll have war bonds in your pockets instead of Axis bonds on your wrists.
Suspense will be heard again 2 weeks from tonight. Next Wednesday night, September 9th, the Columbia Broadcasting System will present over many of these stations at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Wartime an address by W. Averill Harriman, the United States Lend-Lease Administrator in London. Mr. Harriman, as the personal representative of the President of the United States, attended the Moscow conferences between Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin. Next Wednesday's broadcast will be Mr. Harriman's first public address since his return to this country. Suspense is produced and directed by William Spear. John Dietz was our guest director this evening. Tonight's radio drama was written by Lucille Fletcher. The original score was by Bernard Herrmann. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
That was scary. That was the most scary of them of all. Now you know why they say don't pick up strangers. They may be stranger than you think, huh?
Yes, yes.
I don't know where our driver is now, but he sure isn't on the road to happiness, huh? You might even say he has been taken for a ride, huh? But I bet when he first decided to go on his drive, he never envisioned just what a trip it would be. Down, boy, down. Actually, he reminds me of the way I like to drive. The only hitchhikers I pick up are with a fender, huh? Yes, that's what they said. And I notice I'm not the only one with a highway sense of humor. I always see these signs that say, stop ahead. But I never can find them, huh? But someone must want me off the road. They've started to post all these signs near all the intersections with crosses on them, huh? Doesn't give me a ghost of a chance either. Do you know how difficult it is to get anywhere without intersecting an intersection? Well, it's enough to drive me batty, huh? Hey, now you know why I had better fly. So until next week, same bat time, same bat station. This is a count reminding you that when you drive, watch out for glass. Because sometimes the bums hide it under their coats, huh?
Returns control of your radio device to you until next week.
No.